The IntraFish podcast is brought to you by DSM Animal Nutrition and Health, accelerating sustainable and profitable aquaculture.
Hello and welcome to the IntraFish Podcast, where we bring you the most interesting and compelling seafood, aquaculture, fisheries, and aquatech news. I'm Editor-in-Chief Drew Cherry, joined today by Executive Editor John Fiorillo. I hope everyone's doing well as the year is winding down. I know that we're looking forward to it. It has been a crazy year. Right now, we're in the middle of doing our Outlook series. We're talking to some C-suite seafood executives about what they see coming ahead for 2023. And we're kind of rounding up our stories for the top things to look at for 2022, or the top stories that really stood out for 2022. So keep your eye on IntraFish.com, and we'll be rolling those out. But it's given us a lot of food for thought. So we will have an end of the year wrap up, and John and myself, and maybe another guest star or two, will take a look at some of those and dig down a little bit deeper. But today, John, we are going to be talking again about plant-based seafood, which is one of your favorite topics, and one that you've been covering for a long, long time. One that really the industry has, gone on a roller coaster ride with. There has been fear, there has been embrace, there has been all kinds of different ways that different parts of the industry has viewed plant-based seafood. But the bottom line is that many, many companies over the past year in particular have begun to embrace plant-based seafood, and they see it as an important part of their kind of broader offering, and in particular in the frozen branded sector. And just to give you a sense of that, in the UK, Bird's Eye Igloo and Young's, the two largest frozen fish finger and frozen fish suppliers to that market, they've both entered that sector in a big way, really, for Bird's Eye Igloo, a very big way, with its line they call Green Cuisine. And that can sit right alongside, especially in the European markets versus their UK market, can sit right alongside fish sticks. And really, the advertising is pretty interesting, particularly since they actually sell fish sticks, is they'll actually call them fish sticks. And they'll kind of put it in quotations on some of the branding, and then just kind of say sort of tiny vegan fish sticks. So interesting ways to approach, John. You've written a lot about the branding of it. But let's talk today about WWF, the NGO, incidentally, the founder of the Marine Stewardship Council. Typically a group, I would say, John, from my point of view, that has come to the table often with industry to come with some real world solutions, and the MSC is a good example of that. WWF actually founded it in partnership with Unilever, the big fast moving consumer goods group that at that time in the mid 90s and late 90s owned Frozen Fish International, and a lot of the what was called Frozen Fish International, which was producing a lot of the Bird's Eye and Igloo branded fish products. All right, with that setup, WWF Switzerland, a story our colleague Matthew Wilcox looked at, WWF Switzerland did what's called a life cycle assessment or a life cycle analysis. Now, LCA, it's one more sort of eco acronym, I guess we could say, that is probably confusing, certainly confusing to consumers, people that are buying fish, but also really confusing to the industry as well, that's trying to continually wrap its mind around what is the next trend in sustainability. Well, we can answer that. It's emissions. And life cycle analysis is an important part of that. And basically, if you break it down, it is kind of what it sounds like. You're looking at the life cycle of a product from beginning to end. So from the harvesting of the fish, for example, all the way down to when the fish finger is opened up by a consumer and, you know, the cooking begins. So it's supposed to give you a sense of exactly what the overall footprint of a product is. They can be incredibly complicated. You know, we've been looking at some over the past few days, and it's just sort of head scratching as to whether or not this data has any meaning. But again, it's kind of one of the things that is available to measure emissions impact. So WWF did a, I don't want to say study, maybe fact sheet is better, kind of looking at the life cycle analysis of plant-based fish sticks against what we can call, quote unquote, real fish sticks. Let's call it that. Now, most of fish sticks in Europe, and they are extremely popular in Europe, where they're called fish fingers, I should say. Most of them are made with Atlantic cod or Alaska pollock. And so those are pretty well documented fisheries. Most of the fisheries that that harvest large volumes of those fish are certified to the Marine Stewardship Council standard, tend to be well managed. But according to WWF, when they dug into fish and plant-based in this life cycle analysis, they found that plant-based fish fingers have far less of an impact on the environment. And they really wanted to kind of undercut that. Interestingly enough, it seemed like it wasn't out of a desire to say, here is what the impact of fish of fisheries are, but rather, look how great the impact of plant-based fish fingers are, because as Catherine Vogler, she's a senior manager for seafood markets at WWF Switzerland, she told us that in Switzerland, there is a resistance to plant-based alternatives. And one of the main arguments put forward is that, is it because they are highly processed, they're equally damaging to the environment. And their study wanted to take a look at that and found that plant-based perform better. John, it already sparked a lot of strong reactions from the industry. We talked to Craig Morris. He's the executive director of the Association of Genuine Alaska Pollock Producers, a U.S. Alaska Pollock Association that has done life cycle analyses of its fishery. And then, of course, all over social media kind of blown up. And yeah, I'm going to turn it over to you now. What did you make of the study?
Well, first of all, maybe people aren't buying them because they just don't taste good. So, you know, we'll put that aside for a moment. We are talking about food here, so taste is kind of critical. However, let me start by saying it makes total sense. You started your conversation by talking about seafood companies adding it to their portfolio, especially the frozen seafood brands. And that makes total sense to me. I mean, I have no problem with plant-based. It makes sense that if I was selling, you know, fish sticks or whatever it may be, that I would bring in a good product that speaks to a whole nother range of consumers that probably don't want to buy my current product, which is made from real fish. So that makes total sense to me. I see more of that happening in the industry as we go forward. This particular thing that you brought up, the WWF study, where do I start? It bothers me for a couple reasons. First of all, and this is overall the whole marketing approach, it seems, of the plant-based world right now, is to go out there and disparage whatever their competition is, if it's cows or fish or whatever it is. That seems to be the tip of their spear that they lead with. And never been a big fan of that, you know, having to knock somebody down to make yourself better. That doesn't resonate with me personally, or I don't think it's a good tactic overall. The other thing I really wonder about, I'm trying to think like what this means beyond this immediate moment and what it might mean down the road. And this feels an awful lot like me, like the early days of the sustainable seafood movement, where There's this little dipping toe in water type of approach to see what resonates as far as, and not scare tactics, but tactics that say, you should take this product because it has more benefits and positive attributes than that one. So this, I could see this whole life cycle thing becoming really ingrained in a move in this plant-based movement as we go forward as justification for you should be choosing plant-based. Well, I not that I disagree, that there are benefits of plant-based, but it seems to me the sector that whole plant-based sector has become, I don't even know what the right words are, but it's like a mafia almost. And if you disagree, you are really ostracized and, characterized as somebody who doesn't give a hoot about the planet, blah, 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 blah. So there's just a lot of things happening there in the way they're approaching consumers that I don't think are working right now, so they may down the line. But I mean, do you know any consumers that go to the store and want to know the life cycle of their can of peas or what? I don't know. I mean, maybe I don't, but I'm sure people do. But again, we can't even capitalize on the sustainable seafood message that we've had since 1999. This idea that people are going to the Whole Foods and looking for the sustainable seafood, it doesn't bear out. It doesn't bear out in any of the concrete data that you research time and time again. It's a slow drip, sure, over time, but I don't know. I'm not a fan of trying to say, our product is saving the world and your product is destroying it. And when you boil it down, that's what they're saying.
Well, I think your point about sustainable seafood, John, and let me apologize to people listening. I've been fighting off a cold, so I sound like, I'm just talking through a nose. But deal with it. But John, your point about sustainable seafood is interesting, but I'd argue with you there that it's because sustainable seafood in that, if we can call it a movement, has sort of peaked and I don't want to say gone down. It's just that it's now baked in, I think, to consumer expectations and to retail expectations. So I don't think we're really any longer talking about overfishing, for example. And while maybe you and myself may not be sort of in tune with the idea of emissions and emissions as a gauge for whether or not something is sustainable, I do think that a younger generation, that resonates more than sort of some of the other messages, maybe the sort of eco labels that we've gotten used to. And I really do think that we're moving now towards a focus on much more on social and emissions.
Well, I don't disagree with that. I mean, I think that's true. And I remember, I think Hannah on our team wrote a story about labels developing, kind of showing emissions levels, and that's, you can expect that that will be a thing not too far down the road, and you could see this WWF study in particular is a progression in that direction. So I don't disagree, and I'm, I probably sound out of touch. I'm not out of touch about it. I just I'm just not a fan of the approach, but
So let's talk a little bit about plant-based in general as we kind of gotten to the end of the year, because I was looking at our past coverage, and really in the beginning of the year, there was still sort of this exuberance. I personally don't think we've seen even the beginning of what's going to happen with plant-based. But what I am, if I'm looking ahead, say 20 years, it's cell based that I think is much more going to be prominent than plant based, which plant based is just kind of another way to process food, you know, which is, yeah, I mean, there you have it. Is it better for the environment? Is it worse for the environment? It's just another way to process food. But I just wanted to quickly, our friend Dina Shanker at Bloomberg, who, if you haven't read Dina's stuff, you really should, because she covers plant-based companies, and she does a great job keeping up on them, and check her out. But you'll see some of the recent headlines here, and I'll end with my favorite one. But just recently, slaughter-free meat sounds futuristic because it still is, which is a story about just kind of how far away we are from cell-based meat, and how investors are kind of saying, "Huh, this isn't going to come through the way I thought it was as quick as I thought it would." She's reported on scandals Beyond Meat plants, dirty conditions revealed in photos and documents. Beyond Meat cuts more jobs as plant-based meat demand cools. Impossible Foods cuts its workforce and reorganization. You know, once hot fake meat sales slide on price being price and being too quote unquote woke. And then my favorite was, I mean, this, come on, this is the greatest headline in the world. I mean, how do you, what else can you do as a journalist? This story is going to write itself. Beyond Meat COO suspended for biting man's nose after college football game. And it's got a great picture of his mugshot. And I think it kind of sums up in a way where some of the plant-based food producers have gotten very competitive, highly fragmented environment. And then again, it's as you know, it's as vulnerable to the whims of the market as anything else, and even more. And John, you were just saying before we started the podcast that, you know, you've seen deep, deep, deep discounts of some of these products and in on your retail shelves. What's your sort of feeling specifically, let's say specifically plant-based seafood? Where are we in the lifespan then of this? Are we still in the, you know, and the startup going to ramp up, see big growth, or what do you think? Are we going to see kind of a plateau for a while?
Yeah, I mean, we're still in the early stages. I mean, no plant-based seafood companies, to my knowledge, have any true scale yet. It doesn't mean they won't, but I think it goes back to your opening comment. I think when they get to a scale that's considered successful, they will be taken over by the Gortons and the others that dominate the freezer cases for seafood. They're not going to be allowed to chip away at any market share that those guys may want to get from this new segment of consumers. So to me, we're at that stage where everybody's throwing money in it, everybody's doing a little bit. It's, you know, every day there's a new one born, and they're going to do, you know, a different fish cake than the guy next door. So we're in that kind of chaos, right? And then that obviously just goes through a deep, deep funnel and funnels down to a few who survive it, and they usually get acquired somehow by giants. And that's the way I think it is. But as far as let's just look at chilled meat, refrigerated meat alternatives that are out there. Anne-Marie Rohrink, 210 Analytics, sent some numbers through yesterday, as a matter of fact. And she looked at, I'm not going to look at dollar sales because dollar sales to me, with inflation, it's, you know, it's hocus pocus. But I think pound sales, like how much volume of this stuff is being sold compared to, you know, last year or whatever. So for the last 52 weeks ending, let's see, November 27th, pound sales versus a year ago are down 13.5%. And she breaks it down by the quarterly starting in Q1 2021. And since Q3 2021, Pound sales have been falling versus a year ago, significantly, -3.3, -5.5, -7.6, -15, -17, -19 for the whole 4 weeks of November. So this is the product people know best when you say plant-based. Oh yeah, like Beyond Burger. That's what that this is the shining star, the in the meat section for the for plant alternatives. And it's not doing well. Now you gotta give credit to the dairy side of the, well, it's not dairy, but in the dairy aisle where plant-based alternatives, almond milk, those types of oat milk, they're doing really well, and they're doing well against traditional dairy. So, it depends where you are in the store, I suppose. But if we use meat, the current meat situation, to kind of shadow what seafood might do, it doesn't look real great right now.
I wonder too, like you said, is that kind of at the root of what the WWF study was about? Or, are plant-based companies now needing to sort of reach out to some sustainable allies, some NGO allies? Because really the story has been pretty good for Fish Fingers. And I think, as the WWF Switzerland executive said, fish is put forward as a climate-friendly alternative because at least the analyses of harvesting on some of these fisheries has come out okay, even with the diesel usage. Part of the confusing thing to me is life cycle analyses. They don't seem to be apples to apples. And what I mean by that is I'm not quite sure how you compare and score, say, water usage versus water usage of plants that you need to grow for plant-based fish fingers versus water usage of Alaska pollock, which would basically be getting fresh water on board and using it for washing dishes or going to the bathroom or showers or whatever. And similarly, you're not tilling any soil or anything like that. Your product, your protein's already out there in the water, and it's really not contributing or minimally contributing to the environment. So I do wonder sometimes with these life cycle analyses, I mean, how far back should one go? Because what is the life cycle? I mean, the Big Bang? I don't know, or something else if you have other belief systems. So it's I just get a sense that the life cycle analyses, it's going to be sort of used as the next way to measure foods, but I'm not so certain I'm not clear what the meaning of it is exactly. But that could just be me. But I mean, when you read these reports, I mean, they are really complex and they don't add up. And so, for example, I looked at Morningstar Farms report and Impossible, I think it was Impossible Foods reports this morning, and they're so different, but they're producing a similar product. And so it was very, very confusing. And even they had the same analyst group, Qantas, which did an Alaska pollock study. So I'm just confused, and I think I'm going to be just like many other consumers across Europe, Asia, and the United States, and South America and Africa, that will be wondering, what exactly am I supposed to do with all this information? I want a traffic light system. I want an up, I want a down. That's all I need to worry about to make my quick decision.
Yeah, but what's a fishery like the Alaska pollock fishery supposed to do? I mean, it is. It's not in dispute that it's one of the best managed fisheries in the world. And it's not just the industry saying that. Scientists tell you that. These fishery managers are professionals, brilliant scientists. They know what they're doing as best as they can. I mean, the ocean's kind of a mystery no matter what. So what are they supposed to do in the Alaska pollock fishery? They got fully certified by the Marine Stewardship Council, which is the gold standard of third-party certification. They've done hats off to Craig and the people at GAP. They did a life cycle analysis. They did it earlier this year or last year, I don't really remember. But when that press release came over my desk, I was like, what the hell is this all about? Right? So they've already done this. And you know, to now to for WWF to, you know, again call into question, like to me, it's calling into question the fishery itself. So if you follow that to its logical conclusion and understand that the fishery is sustainable as best we can measure, et cetera, then they just don't want the fishery to exist, is where I end up with stuff like this. And you know, that wouldn't surprise anybody, I don't think, but yeah, so the whole thing, you know, I'm sorry, I'm sounding like the old man that I probably am, but the whole thing, it just seems smoke and mirrors to me at this point. I think, you know, as it evolves, like you just said, there's a lot of apples to oranges here, and you know, maybe a single kind of measurement will come about that can make things a little fairer and maybe easy to understand, but I don't think this WWF thing is that at all.
Well, let me use what you just said to kind of springboard onto a couple other elements of this that I think are really, really, really salient. One here is that the emissions and the ranking of proteins is, I think, going to become a larger issue. Now, the Fair Collar Initiative, which is a consortium of investors that research investments in different segments, including the protein sector, they did another report. They do one annually, ranking, bear in mind, publicly listed companies. So any information that's out there with non-publicly listed companies or that's not released to the public, if that information, I'm not sure if they are all public, but at least quasi, and being able to release you know, data on what they do. But once again, salmon farmers came out, I mean, really, really looking good. If you were to take this research at its value, and there's questions about, like any research and any of these groups, it's sometimes difficult to see what their ranking systems are and whether or not they are arbitrary. However, in this particular ranking, by all the different measures that they have put in place, salmon is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 of the top 10 companies. That's kind of astonishing. So number one, the number one, as they are describing it, I guess we could say most sustainable protein is maybe a way to put it. You could probably kind of drill in on that a little bit better, if you were to kind of, you know, drill down on the different factors. But I think that's the best way to describe how what this report is doing. So Moovie, the world's largest salmon farming company, it's got a market cap of $12 billion, sits right at the top. Right at the top. Grieg, also Norway based, right below it. Lerøy Seafood, also up there. Salmonis Camanchaca, Chilean salmon farmer. Bakkafrost, Faroese salmon farmer. Multi-X, Chilean salmon farmer. And SalMar, Norwegian salmon farmer, are all up there very, very high. Now, a big part of that is looking at feed conversion ratio, but also looking at emissions and factors like that. Now, just to bring that back around a bit, John, about fishing and about these fisheries. Now, this is going to be open for debate, and so as people listen to the podcast, by all means, you know where to get us, so you can call and argue. And I really would like to hear people's points on this, but I do think that fishing is in for some scrutiny on emissions that they should be aware of, and it's been quite interesting. I think we've spoken about this in some of the past podcasts, and certainly we've written about it. But the fishing industry is increasingly, I think, becoming more on the defensive, or it needs to get more on the defensive, because it will be on the emissions story because of some of the fuel usage, and because aquaculture is so it's so tightly controlled from beginning to end. And so there's so much more actionable data. But I think when you look at this, these statistics, bear in mind, Leroy Seafood, a good chunk of its company is whitefish harvesting. And they're in at number four. So, you know, take that for what it's worth when you're hearing me make this argument. But I would say that aquaculture is now in a slightly more of a pole position on making some of these arguments, which may be why I think we're seeing this fairly dramatic shift over the past 2 years, 3 years of NGOs and others embracing aquaculture as a sustainable protein alternative. But that struck me in the life cycle analysis that aquaculture may have a better story to tell than fisheries, certainly than some fisheries, depending on their efficiency, depending on how they harvest, the length of time they harvest. Things can get complex because, as is the case here, let's say we took the WWF findings at its word, which Alaska pollock industry argues that no, it's not accurate. But if we did take it at its word, what we would find then is that a sustainably managed fishery, the Alaska pollock fishery is one of the first certified to the MSC standard. So we find ourselves in this situation where a sustainably managed fishery could be putting out more emissions than a, let's say, whatever, quote unquote, unsustainable production method or aquaculture, well-produced aquaculture. And so it's kind of interesting. It puts the industry and puts kind of everyone in this odd spot of, well, which one do you really recommend then? You know, and I don't even want to get into recommendations in Seafood Watch. We talked about that a couple podcasts ago. We'll talk about it again in the new year, I think, or maybe at our next podcast before as we wrap up the end of the year. But John, this does speak to, and this was kind of the discussion on social media, that oftentimes it seems some of these NGOs, I feel like I thought this had changed a lot more over the years, but I'm seeing it kind of crop back up. But it seems like the right hand either doesn't know what the left hand's doing, or intentionally the right hand is pretending like it doesn't know what the left hand is doing. And what I mean by that is a message from WWF Switzerland. I don't see WWF as a group or in other regions going out and kind of touting this finding. And so it's almost like let's sneak it into the Swiss market.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's debated all the time, whether NGOs need to, I don't want to say fabricate, but inflate issues to keep them relevant, keep funding, et cetera, et cetera. And you know, that happens. This might be happening here. I don't know. But I think the point you made a few minutes ago is really one that industry should take away from this. And that is kind of take the lead from the genuine Alaska pollock producers and look into this life cycle stuff for your fishery. You know, we said during the broadcast, whether I like it or not, or Drew likes it or not, is irrelevant. What is relevant is this is becoming another way to measure food, to give consumers ultimately, I guess, a way to say that chicken's better or that plant-based thing is better than that chicken or whatever it may be. So no reason to get sideswiped here. We, you see it coming. what it maybe call Craig Morris over there and kind of get a sense of why he did this, earlier this year, and how he went about it, and adopt it for your own fishery or your company or whatever it may be, because these things grow, as we know, and this is one of those things that has sprouted and is growing.
Well, and we're in a far more sophisticated time than when people were hanging banners off, retailers. I mean, this is definitely a period where the financial industry has gotten involved. It impacts interest rates on loans and all kinds of other factors to be able to prove that your business is sustainable or setting sustainability targets. And so I agree with you, John, that it's coming. Emissions will be number one, I believe, in terms of assessing the sustainability of a product, sustainability of a fishery, sustainability of a aquaculture production method. That sits in another area where I think consumers are really expecting it, and I think rightly so, that they should expect that when something is served to them, that aspect of it is taken care of. And I think we have so much more technology, so much more certification methodologies, so many ways to ensure that those are being done as sustainable as possible. But the emissions side of things is where I think you're going to find a lot more scrutiny. And you see that many, many companies that have that are involved in this have set targets. It's complex, and I can imagine that a lot of people in the industry are rolling their eyes and going, "Oh my God, one more thing that I have to calculate and track." But in service of what your customers are going to ask for, that will likely be something that'll be needed. Major companies have said it. Of course, people like Cargill, who have plenty of money to throw at setting up whole departments to look into this. But also, kind of some of the quote unquote smaller companies like Grieg Seafood, for example. Laroy Seafood has also set up targets as well. And you can see people are kind of feeling their way in the dark to know quite what targets to set and how it should work. And, we've done a little bit of reporting on some of the goals that Cargill and Skretting have set for themselves on emissions. And once you set a target, that means you are either going to meet them or you're not going to meet them. And so you mentioned Hanna Gazelius, who's been tracking this in particular on the feed side, and she just looked at the Cargill report, sustainability report, and Cargill went actually in the wrong direction last year. And part of that has to do with things that are absolutely out of their control. So inflation, for example, or shipping and logistics costs and blah, blah, blah. Or think about this. Your emissions will, of course, go up if you expand. So as an expanding business, and every business wants to grow, and that's all they're focused on if they really want to survive, is how do I grow, maintain, or grow my profit margin? So Cargill, of course, absolutely wants to grow in aquaculture, and it's shown us that in big ways this year. Now, as you grow, your emissions outputs are going to grow. That's just simple math. And Cargill now also is moving from a cold water species, which is in the ocean, requires, it does require effort and energy use to keep to raise fish. But compared to land-based fish farming, it's so much smaller. Warm water species are going to have a significantly higher emissions footprint. I'm not talking about land-based salmon farming. They've got their own thing that they're kind of touting in terms of route to market. But if you look at things like warm water shrimp, if you look at tilapia, pangasius, that's going to be an interesting thing that they're going to have to face, both people supplying them like Cargill, but also the companies themselves. So there's just a lot in the mix there on, you know, on how companies are going to need to factor in their emissions. And it's just a much different game when it comes to sustainability. And I think it's really in its infancy of how this is measured. But I think I would argue that sustainable seafood as a term, you know, that I think is kind of baked in more than it ever has been before, John. I don't know that you feel that same way.
Yeah, no, I think so. I mean, I guess my point was, you know, your point, it seems to be consumers just assume the fish they're getting at Kroger or wherever is sustainable. And I agree with that. But my point was that these groups, you know, as they've gone along this sustainability journey, there's been attempts to rally consumers to this whole message and, you know, through some marketing, and that's never stuck. You know, that they've done a poor job of that, and I think they'll even admit it. But I think when I go to QFC or Safeway, I just assume the guy behind the fish counter isn't buying fish off the back of a truck, you know, from some guy down the road. So yeah, I agree.
You know, I think the emissions labeling that we're seeing, I think Denmark is going to be one of the first ones to roll it out on food products. And then the European Commission, I think, is working on its own. I'm assuming the UK will likely follow. Certainly, European countries not in the EU will follow. And it'll take a longer timeline, but I would imagine that kind of traffic light labeling in the U.S. will come probably as a voluntary standard, not necessarily a mandatory standard. But I can see how, given the pressure on the Walmarts of the world and the Ciscos and all the other retail and food service buyers, these things will, I'm sure, in the boardroom, they're discussing them as we speak and discussing how they're going to do climate labeling. Climate labeling, to me, has one big ace in the hole. And that's that it's extremely universal. The stoplight is one of the things we can all agree on around the world, that red means stop, green means go, yellow means, I don't know, wait a little bit. But you can see from Seafood Watch, again, touching on it only briefly, that consumers really like that level of simplicity when they're being told what they should or shouldn't eat. And so, buckle up. I think it's coming. And I think that this study is probably the first of many that we'll be rolling out of life cycle analyses. There's going to need to be, study versus study. They'll be like the Pollock industry did. They're putting their research up against what WWF and saying, hey, ours is far more thorough. And you're going to start to see those arguments all over the place. I think you'll see aquaculture companies rebutting NGO analyses, and it's going to be a mess. But as you said, John, I think you're spot on. Buckle up and get ready. The industry is going to have to really start showing its carbon footprint. So, yeah. Go ahead and get ready for that paperwork. You better find somebody on your staff who's going to have responsibility for that, or budget in for a new staff member to take care of it. I'm sure everyone's really excited to be hearing about that, John.
Yeah, I wonder what our carbon footprint is.
I don't like to think about it, but I don't know. We'll start to factor that in. But, you know, we're not raising fish or catching them yet. Although it's not a bad side hustle. So we can look into that in the new year. We're going to wrap it up there. Don't forget that you can go to interfish.com and catch all our coverage. Right now, we are rolling out our Outlook series, C-suite executives from around the world. We're just asking them what were the main things that were of concern to them and what they're seeing for the year ahead. So, again, really recommend that you look at that and get some sense from these thought leaders of where your business might need to be going, where the industry is going, and if you're hearing it directly from the horse's mouth. So we've got those rolling out. We've already had some fantastic CEOs and top executives that have given us their opinions, and we'll have more of them rolling out, especially as we go over the holidays here. And then we'll collect them, and in the new year when you come back from your breaks, if hopefully you get a break, you can come back and really study those as you start planning out what 2023 is going to look like for you. All right, folks, we'll look forward to talking to you next time. Thanks for joining us.
The IntraFish podcast is brought to you by DSM Animal Nutrition and Health, accelerating sustainable and profitable aquaculture.